two-minute walk away. It will be in the Nielsen Library of Smith College browsing room, okay? And it will be Thursday, May 8th, and the speaker is, I think, the most important Jungian on the planet.
No offense, Penny.
No offense to all of us Jungians in the room, but I think this fellow is tremendous and has done some very, very important work. It's amazing we can get him here in our little group, but he's also doing some work in Boston. And if anybody's interested, I've got that information, and you can come up and get the dates if you want more Donald Kalshed. So I should tell you his name. Donald Kalshed, and his topic in 2 months, on a Thursday night, will be Trauma and the Soul, Psycho-Spiritual Considerations in Clinical Practice. So please come, please tell your friends. I think we're going to have a small reception afterwards. It should be fabulous. Okay, then this is just the general announcements, which many of you know. We do not take a break. We will finish around 9:15, but we don't take a break. So there is a restroom just out in this little hallway and also a women's room at the end of the hall. Just slip out if you need to during the talk. If you can, we request a $10 donation, please. There are baskets at either end, and we appreciate if you can give a little more, that's fabulous. If you can give just a little, that's fabulous. But please, that is our only source of income, so we appreciate whatever you can do. And my final announcement is that we now, we now have these lectures, most of these lectures, in podcast form. So if you miss a lecture or you would like to hear it again, you can go to our website, www.westmassjung.org, and there's a section for, is it called podcasts?
Audio archive.
And there are a handful of lectures there now, and it's free, and you just listen to them on your computer. Any questions before I get to my introduction? Okay. So tonight's lecture is by Penelope Tarasuk. Penny attended Philadelphia College of Art, received a BA in psychology and an MA in counseling from the University of Maryland, and got her doctorate at International University. She was one of the very first students and graduates of the C.G. Jung Institute in Boston, and she graduated from there in 1988. While working as a psychotherapist for 40 years, 26 of them as a Jungian analyst, Penny has worked in a wide range of areas, including suicide prevention, drug abuse, and trauma treatment. She has led a group for grieving parents, which met for a number of years, I believe, and she's run dream groups, and this is just a few of the many professional accomplishments of her psychological career. And this next part just really moves me and impresses me. She integrated her interest in nature into this psychological work, or I don't know which way, but she integrated them when she lived in Santa Fe by consulting with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society concerning issues of human violence inflicted upon animals, the impact of animal suffering upon staff, and the necessity of community humane education. Mm. That just moves me so much. That is just beautiful. In addition to all of this, she is an artist and a writer and studies Buddhism, or is a Buddhist. Currently, Penny is a faculty member and training analyst at the Boston Jung Institute and has a private practice in Deerfield, Mass., and Cambridge, Mass. It's a pleasure to welcome Penny tonight to speak on the topic, Turning a Blind Eye.
Thank you, Penny. Oh, okay. I can't see at all. Wait a second. Let me just see everybody first. Okay. Okay. It's a very blind eye. Yes. Good evening, and thank you for coming out tonight. It's another raw, wintry weekend. I probably would have delivered this if only two people were here, because last fall when I was asked what I might like to speak on, I just said I'd like to maybe talk about a blind eye and Oedipus and Cassandra and a few other things. And little did I know that I was really going to be taken over by this topic, because it led me down many paths that were very difficult. It's been very difficult to hold this material. And if you're at all uncomfortable tonight, just get up and move around or take a walk or whatever. But I'm really hoping that that I have something to say to you, and I hope to leave some time for responses or questions. So I'm going to get right to it. And thank you, Dan, and thank you, Kate, and thank you, Karen. Thank you, Smith. Okay. I'm not going to be talking about Oedipus's blindness or Hecate's response to Persephone or Cassandra's seeing, but I'm really going to be talking about Pandora's box, or rather, what escaped from the vessel that she was given. And I'm going to be talking about the shadow, the personal shadow, and the collective shadow, and the archetypal shadow, and the archetypal shadow, the self, and I'm going to talk about evil to some degree. This talk arose from my response to the Jerry Sandusky case last year. He was the assistant coach of the football, one of the football programs at Penn State University, and he had been brought up on charges of child abuse. So it was a case about pedophilia. It was a case about cover-up and obstruction of justice on many levels, and I just could not look away. And one of the first images of Jerry Sandusky on the news was him in a red jumpsuit with a black shirt and a white T-shirt under it. And what I was struck by was these are the basic colors of alchemy. The black of negredo and depression, the white of albedo, or the whitening, or the purification through tears and reflection, and the red, which he was covered with in this suit, the blood and the passion of life. And in his case, you know, there may have been blood too. So I'd like to... one of the things that caught me in the transcripts of some of the emails between the vice president of the university and staff was that he said that, are we opening Pandora's box here? So it just felt like I had to do this. So I wanted to know for myself, what is the message here? And what complexes are stirred within me and anybody who saw that material. So I'm using the phrase, turning a blind eye. You can lower the lights now. It's good. Yeah, lights can go down. Turning a blind eye. When we turn a blind eye, it assumes that one of the eyes sees and the other eye doesn't. So we're immediately talking about a split, a psychological split within the person who's turning the blind eye. I don't know who came to Anita Green's last talk, but what I realized is that when we look at something, even before we turn a blind eye, if that's what we do, we perceive, we feel in our gut, in our endocrine system, in our central nervous system, we feel below verbal consciousness. And very quickly, we decide on a course of action. Either we turn a blind eye to the messages and our deepest wisdom, or we look at whatever it is that's difficult. a lot of what we're going to talk about today is it's difficult. There's cognitive dissonance. We don't want to hear this. We don't want to deal with this. We don't really want to feel what it brings up in us. There are easier ways. There's easier ways to just walk away. The ego doesn't really want to confront this stuff. All of this happens in a flash, microseconds. And the actual saying, to turn a blind eye, reportedly came from an incident of Admiral Lord Nelson, who supposedly said this when he willfully disobeyed a signal to withdraw during a naval engagement. And he actually was blind in one eye, and he had a telescope. And when he heard that he wasn't supposed to proceed with the battle, he literally turned the blind eye and then proceeded to do what he wanted to do, what his ego wanted to do, and proceeded with the battle. So, a really quick nutshell of the story of Pandora's Box. It's very interesting. When I was a little girl, we had books with fairy tales and mythology. And I remember the picture of Pandora's Box, and I read part of it, but I stopped reading because it was too difficult. So the Titan Prometheus, whose name means forethought, stole fire from the gods to help mankind. He stole illumination, consciousness from the gods. Zeus and the other gods were very angry about this theft and wanted revenge. They wanted payback, so to speak, and they decided to create Pandora, the first human woman. It seems that she was set up or tricked from the very start, if you ask me. And they created her, Pandora, which means all gifted one, and gave her gifts of their own skills and beauty and intelligence, including curiosity by Hera. The gods gave her, as a gift, a wife gift to Epimetheus. I may be pronouncing it wrong, but he's the brother of Prometheus, and his name means afterthought, i.e. not reflective. Anyway, they gave Pandora and the box to him, and she was supposed to keep it safe, or they were, but anyway, it's usually referred to as her. Brother Prometheus warns, don't accept this from the gods, because he knew, he understood that the gods were going to seek revenge for his theft. But so the story unfolds. Surely the gods knew. Surely they were aware of human weaknesses, or the strength of curiosity, and surely they knew Pandora would not be able to stand the tension and would have to open it, and she did, and then unleashed the evils of the world onto the world. This was the gods' punishment to mankind for Prometheus's stealing of fire or consciousness from the gods. And to her horror, in opening the box, the evils escaped, manifesting in the world. So, Pandora had to bear the guilt of releasing all of that. But the backstory is the gods knew what they were doing. And just as she was ready to slam down the lid and seal it forever, she heard a faint, hauntingly beautiful sound from deep within the vessel. And underneath, and this is what I didn't learn as a child, underneath, at the bottom of the vessel, was one thing, and it was hope. Speaking in a voice so subtle and faint that it required all the use of her gifts to hear the whisper. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to use all of our gifts to hear the whisper of something that is called hope. In a very small vignette, when my first son was about 4 or 5, I was in Jungian training. I was pregnant when I started. And I'd been a therapist before. I had a lot of training. So we were outside, summer day, kids from the neighborhood bringing their toys onto our Victorian porch. And they were all setting up, playing house. And there was a new little girl in the neighborhood, beautiful little girl, long hair, kind of tall, looked a little older than she was. She was probably about 6. So each child's making up these little stories of the what's going on in their houses. And I'm serving crackers and watching and whatnot. Well, this little girl built a house, made herself a bedroom, and then she put the daddy on top of her in the bed. And my gut reaction was, something's really wrong here. And I turned a blind eye. Very quickly, I made some decisions such that, well, maybe I'm wrong, or I don't want to get in trouble, or I can't do anything about this, or my kids are safe, or, you know, you name it, but I turned a blind eye. But it haunted me. By the way, that little girl and her parents, who were renting an apartment up the street, moved within a few weeks and gone. It was like she was a specter. So I carried that with me for years, and I still feel it, because I really betrayed something in my own body. But what it did is it began a process for me of having to look at why I did that, and it began to open to my own history of quite a lot of abuse and deprivation. And what I found in my Jungian training is they really weren't prepared to do trauma work. So I put it away. And it wasn't really until after I finished my training that I found someone really trained in early childhood development and trauma, hypnosis, all kinds of things. And I began to search for that missing child. So it really set me on a path of very deep exploration in myself. And any of you who have children, which I'm sure there's plenty of you here, as the child grows through different stages, it echoes inside you, in your memory, and it brings up unresolved issues for you, which is a gift, but it's also somewhat of a curse, because you're exhausted and you're dealing with everything. But I was in training, and I did have support for a great deal. But those were the days that the Jungian training was much more, I would say, intellectual and symbolic. But there wasn't a lot of real world. I felt very lonely in my training. And I was the only woman in training. And there was one woman analyst. And she'd never had children. And it just wasn't going to happen in my training at that time. So anyway, that's a vignette, a personal vignette. And I'm sure you all have your own, too. So next, I'm going to talk about several examples that I've found in the media recently. This is from a Frank Bruni column in the New York Times, December 8th, Sunday New York Times. And it illustrates a piece he did on Zero Dark Thirty, one of the movies up for an Academy Award, which I haven't seen, partially because I'm walking around whether I want to sit through the torture part, even if it is mock, etc. In the name of democracy, we have long done and we continue to do some ruthless and cost-benefit analyses and some very ugly things to which we should never turn a blind eye. Frank Bruni. Whatever Zero Dark Thirty gets wrong, and the torture depicted in the film is still being debated. Hollywood's artistic license. The film gets some things right. So the issue of torture is one that we want to turn a blind eye to. And as I was getting ready to write this, one of the things I was reminded of was that in early, I think it was around 2005-ish, when rendition and the plan, what was it called? What is that interrogation called?
Waterboarding?
No, but there's another word for enhanced interrogation, which means torture. There were several APA psychologists involved in writing the manuals. Now, it was unethical, but they did it anyway. And part of that was because there was a great deal of money involved in the military research contracts and a number of psychologists. This later came to light in the larger organization, and the president was ousted. There was an uproar, but it is still not fully and absolutely resolved. And what I could find is at least one of the two men who wrote the manuals, and not just wrote them, but was there in the room when it was happening, not as a compassionate witness, but as to making sure it was effective. He was brought up on ethics charges in Texas for this violation, and it was not, he was not let go. He was not, there was not a consequence. So I just want to say and actually there was a seminar at Mount Holyoke a couple of years ago. One of the psychologists brought in a number of people. And as alarming as that is, I still feel a little, you know, like, how did that happen? And I want to say that torture by any name, extraordinary rendition, etc., it deconstructs the effective connections between human beings. It specifically deconstructs the effective connection between human beings. It destroys kinship. So it's an ultimate betrayal of kinship. I do want to say that the AMA forbid their doctors to be part of the torture. So I do want to say that. So another example of the turn a blind eye was I was reading Tom Brokaw's comments on gun violence regarding Newtown, Connecticut and the Sandy Hook school shooting. And this is Tom Brokaw, very experienced journalist. Guns are the final tool in the breakdown of a lot of things. The breakdown of mental health facilities, for example. At the same time, we seem to have a kind of cultural violence, he continued. We're turning a blind eye. It's more and more vivid on video games and films, on television, even in the game of football. It's more violent than ever before, and there's a kind of celebration of that. So, and this is two mothers at that evening. And, you know, the pain is unbearable. But what's really important is they are really in communion, in grief there. They are eye to eye. They're touching. And there's, you know, they're in shock. I co-led a group of parents who'd lost their children for about 5 years with a Boston area psychologist who was not a Jungian, but I brought a whole other dimension of depth that they weren't used to. And my experience is it is like entering a hell realm to sit with parents who've lost their children. And it is unending. They may find some distance. But after 7 years, it takes, you know, literally very little to be right back in the moment of that tearing, rending of that very deep connection. So what was amazing is the last group with the parents that I had with David Treadway was the night before Newtown. So we were working on closure that night. So you can imagine separation was one of the most difficult things that any of us could be dealing with. And then this happened in the following morning. The next day. So it really hit me because it is the ripples of shock and the rending of the fabric of the soul along with the body between parents, in families, in the community, in the schools, in the sports. You know, I mean, it just, the waves go on and on, and it will go on and on for years. And this happens whenever a child is lost, but this was easier to focus on because it was so horrific. And I'd like to say, I thought that the service where the different denominational people spoke, it was just a very beautiful holding experience. I felt held by it just watching it. And I thought that the president's presence was really very authentic. So, and this is Avalokiteshvara, a Tibetan deity, related to compassion. This is actually the deity that the Dalai Lama is supposedly the embodiment of. And Avalokiteshvara has at least 1,000 arms, and on each hand is an eye that sees all the suffering of the world. And from the eyes, they're all crying. And so the suffering of the world is known, and it is archetypal, and it goes on, and it will go on. But there is this sense of the compassionate deity who really hears. Okay, now we're going to enter the Jerry Sandusky case. Turning a blind eye is also about twisting, and it twists an emotional experience because the direct experience is something is really wrong in our gut, but we twist it and try and make it make other sense. And in its deepest twisting, I believe, is perversion. And that comes from the same root, version. Okay. So this is Jerry Sandusky under arrest, wearing the alchemical colors. Buzz Bissinger, Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and author of Saturday Night Lights, both the movie and the ongoing Friday night series about the small town in Texas with a football team. The mom's a counselor and the father's a coach. Very good show. Anyway, Buzz is a famous sports writer. He wrote this. He reported on the corruption in the entire system from Sandusky up to the college president, the board of trustees, the police departments, etc. What happened, or more accurately, did not happen, goes to the core of evil. That major college sports programs in this country have become equivalent to mafia families in which the code of omerta rules, and coaches and staff always close ranks, and we'll see that again later in the talk, around their own. Even if it means letting someone who was the first accused of inappropriate sexual conduct in 1998, even though letting him continue to roam. The first reported incident was in 1998. That was 14 years that he was loose and continuing to molest and rape children. Last year, the criminal case of Jerry Sandusky and Penn State is it college or university?
University.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Slowly revealed in the media the case of pedophilia and administrative collusion, corruption, and denial, which was of such magnitude that I was really moved to bear witness. What happened? Okay. And this is Jerry Sandusky quoted here. And part of what I want you to notice is his psychological defenses of, among other things, denial and projection. Sandusky was a psychopath. He flourished and was supported, even celebrated, by the respected university with its high-caliber sports program. He was respected in the community, the larger community, and in 1977, he formed a nonprofit called the Second Mile for neglected and deprived children. 1977. He flourished and was supported by his family, his wife of 40 years. They were unable to have children. They were foster parents, and they also adopted 6 children, and they all lived in their home. How could this be? It took 14 years from the initial complaint of the mother of an 11-year-old schoolboy in 1998. She called the school administration when complaining that her son had come home with wet hair, and when she asked him about it, he said, well, he showered with Jerry Sandusky, which apparently was a common thing. And, you know, he was a trusted coach. People let him be with their children in all kinds of ways. The mother did not turn a blind eye, but she was not taken seriously. She did not get confirmation. She sensed something was really wrong and tried to open a complaint with school authorities. Before and during this time, it's estimated that several hundred boys were sexually abused by this man. The Second Mile program was active for 35 years. It is now shut down. By the way, Rick Santorum gave Jerry Sandusky an Angel Award during this time. And that's been rescinded, but I think, you know, they got it really wrong. And the famous iconic Joe Paterno, who was head of the sports program. The college administration, up to the president and the trustees, the police, possibly the DA, we're in a conspiracy of silence and complicity. This could be named evil. May 3rd, 1998, victim 6 is assaulted in the locker rooms and showers at Penn State when he's 11. His mother reports it to the university police. May 4th through 30th, 1998, Penn State University Vice President Gary Schultz is informed of this event. In his email notes of that date, he said, quote, behavior, at best inappropriate, at worst sexual improprieties. He also notes, is this the opening of Pandora's box? And other children? Question mark. Jerry Sandusky was permitted consciously and unconsciously to carry out a form of torture and tyranny, leaving a trail of shattered psyches, damaged sexuality, and probably damaged bodies as well. He fed on vulnerable boys. He did He was sentenced to 60 years in prison, and I assume that he'll die in prison one way or the other. But there was an image that kept coming to me as I was learning all this, and it's a painting by Goya. And Goya painted it in a very dark period in his own life during the time that the Spanish government was oppressing the individuals. And the painting is inspired by Rubens' work, and it's called Saturn Devouring His Children. Goya saw the tyranny of the Spanish state over the individual. And in the myth, Saturn Kronos, same person, same deity, was afraid that his children would supersede him, and it was foretold that he would be killed by his son Zeus. And this eventually happened. What I see is a killer of innocence, a devourer of souls. I see a soul murderer. I have a lot of feelings about this. Why do we turn a blind eye? This is a cyclops. And as you can see, the cyclops is essentially kind of blind with his actual eyes, and he has this one eye in the center of his forehead, a single eye. But this eye, I like to think of this as the eternal eye, that the only thing that exists is I. This is pathological narcissism. There is only I. It's only me. It's what I want. It's what I need. If you're with me, I don't see you. I see you as some projection of my own needs. And I'm even assuming you want the same thing I do. But you do not relate as though the other person is a subject. The other is really an extension of your wishes. Pathological narcissism. So I thought the Cyclops was a really wonderful image for that. Now we have another eye. This is the eye of God, from the archetypal painting, Sacred Allegory. And this is the eye of the self that sees all within the soul. That sort of ever-present consciousness of all, including the interior of us. Okay. So, I noticed several interesting things. It's a beautiful picture. This is the Vatican, and the Pope, I believe, is way down there at the end. If you'll notice, the colors are predominantly red, white, and gold. Now, what's missing is black, the shadow. And what we see down at the end are the altar boys. Now, I have to tell you that the altar boys have often been the victims of the priest. And I live next to two altar boys, so I can personally tell you that they learned abusive things. And if you also noticed, you see that they close ranks. This is a very tight private circle. Sexual abuse scandal within the Catholic Church. For decades, perhaps centuries, the priests within the Catholic Church in the U.S., Ireland, England, Europe, Africa, Asia, Central America, South America, around the world, from humble community parish churches to the height of the papal bureaucracy in Rome, have participated in sexual abuse of children and adults directly and indirectly. For decades, probably centuries, they turned a blind eye. Or worse, in many instances, priests and bishops, cardinals colluded in the perpetration of these crimes. They protected their own members. Remember, like the mafia, the Omerta? They protected their own members while callously exposing the most vulnerable humans, those dependent upon them. Children. Especially poor and oppressed children, students, altar boys. There was also quite a lot of abuse of adults. One of the people in my dream group, this person's long deceased now, was 90 years old at the end of the dream group. It was 11 years long. This woman was a widow. Well, her husband was dying of cancer. She had 6 children. She was a journalist. The priest would come and require fellatio for years. And all the way through this woman's life, she was trying to make it make sense that this had something to do as a gift to God, which, you know, at some very abstract level, but she kept trying to incorporate what this had done to her. So this is pathological narcissism, enhancing oneself at the expense of the other. This is soul murder. They abused and violated their privilege and the trust granted to their positions. Their egos identified with archetypal power were identified with archetypal power and inflated with the idea of infallibility. This is betrayal. Kate, please. This is pathological narcissism, enhancing oneself at the expense of the other. The Pope and the Catholic Church set themselves above civil law, above the law of the lands and people. The Catholic Church has paid out already over $2 billion in lawsuits, and there will be many more successful ones. I'd also like to note that in the United States, the Catholic bishops in California sent their pedophile priests to New Mexico, where they abused many poor and oppressed children. And supposedly the priests were there for treatment. But what happened is, there's another twist, is that California sent them to New Mexico because the statute of limitations in California would run out and they would have to pay vast sums. The repercussions and revelations go on, and the extent of the abuse and complicity of cover-ups is very well documented now, and the consequences are earth-shaking. The Pope resigned, 2 weeks ago? I mean, writing this piece, all this stuff just is like a wound opened. It is putrid. This is hubris. Next, Kate. Oh, actually, you can go back one. I want to read a quote from Jung about enantiodromia, that great word that we never use. Jung: I use the term for the emergence of the unconscious opposite in the course of time, the play of opposites in the course of events, that which turns into its opposite. That which was set too high falls to great depths. So if we just want to take 1 minute and stand up and stretch a little bit and breathe a little bit, I'm going to take a drink, but just make a little noise and stretch. Thank you. Shake it out a little bit. Okay. So let's go back and sit down again. And go on to the next slide. And I put several of these Buddhist images in for my sake. But this is a Buddhist stupa in Nepal. And the stupa is a psycho-cosmic structure. And I'm not going to go into describing the whole thing, but each level has a particular meaning and a particular alchemical function. The four sides have the eyes, and really the meaning of Buddha is the awakened one. So it's about seeing simultaneously in all directions and through all time. So now what I'm going to talk about is a little bit more about the psychology of human development and attachment theory. I'm going to try and bring this into psychology a little bit. And I am a Jungian analyst, but I would like to just say a few things about being a Jungian analyst. It really is a root for me, and I really love what Carl Jung did, and I love the work around imagery and imagination and spirituality and religion and on and on and on. But there were some gaps in Jung's work, and he didn't have to know everything. And part of what's going on is we're incorporating a lot of new material as we go, and there's been a great deal of I would say improvement in looking at early development in particular and neurobiology. And as Anita said, Jung seemed to have had a sense of this early, but I would say a lot of people who carried out his work didn't really have this sense. The British psychologist John Bowlby, who's famous for his World War II era studies of attachment and loss, was followed by the research of Mary Ainsworth on attachment and Mary Main of Berkeley, California. And they essentially formed a description of the attachment patterns that are understood to be cross-cultural, universal, and non-language dependent. Michael Fordham, also English, was a friend and colleague and translator of Jung's collected works. And he began to develop a working theory of infancy and the development of early psychological defenses. And he had something called defenses of the self. And he talked about autistic defenses, not autistic in the sense of diagnosis, but in a descriptive sense. And I know Donald Kalshad is coming in May, and his work on the inner world of trauma focuses much more deeply on this very deep and resilient defensive system. I don't know how many of you have read his work, but he talks a great deal about internal protectors and how finally we become a prisoner to those defenses. Which is, I think he's going to go on with in his new work. It should be very interesting. But anyway, Michael Fordham started watching, observing infants, and brought that into the Jungian training. So it was really enhancing and taking this into a new direction. In the United States, Alan Shore, among others, became interested in articulating neurobiology and emotional development. And attachment. Alan Shore, and I'm hoping he gets some great award for his work, but he has brought together thousands of pieces of research and integrated them, and he can communicate them. His first major book was 1994, Affect Regulation and the Origin of the Self. And later, he wrote Dysregulation and Repair of the Self, which is more about treatment of early attachment issues and early problems in affect regulation. The essence of what he learned was that it doesn't really matter what theory you're working with. The deepest connection and the deepest healing is right hemisphere to right hemisphere. And that often involves the nonverbal realm, the realm of images, the realm of feeling. And he mentioned Jung a number of times because Jung did seem to have an understanding of the complex as biologically based. And Alan Shore and the other neuropsychologists have carried this on in a beautiful way. So really what I'm talking about is the convergence of theories. There's been an exponential increase in the understanding of human behavior, especially early behavior, the health, the pathology, and the repair. And we are learning that actually the brain changes in a very effective therapy. There's literally new synaptic connections. It actually changes the brain. So now I'd like to talk just a little bit. I'm not going to go too deeply in it, but the major attachment patterns that we all have experienced. And the first one is the secure attachment, which if you're really lucky, you're born into that kind of situation. But I would say most of the people in therapy come from the middle, ones, the two insecure ones. And we're lucky if somebody from this last category can be held in treatment because the attachment is so disturbed. In insecure attachment, it is really where basic trust is developed. And that's where the caregiver or the mother is a secure base for exploration. And there's protest if this mother figure leaves. And when she I'm going to use mother and she, although I know that there are other people mothering children too. The child seeks proximity and is comforted upon her return, and then goes back to exploring the world. And the child might be comforted by a stranger, but really prefers that primary caretaker. And inside the mother figure or the caregiver, she responds appropriately, promptly, and consistently to the child's needs. And she has successfully formed a secure parental attachment to the child. So that's what we really, you know, that's sort of the golden possibility. I've shown this picture in another talk. I love it. This is a newborn, and this mother is, to go back to Anita's talk, this mother is in the archetypal affective state of joy. And she has received the baby and is making connections skin to skin, very deep neurobiological connection. And I would assume, just from observing that, that there's a lot of hope for this baby. Now, the second, you can go back. Insecure, which creates mistrust. And I would say all of us have probably some or a lot of these two possibilities, anxious or ambivalent. For the child, there's little affective sharing in play, little or no distress upon departure of the mother figure, little or no visible response to the return of this mothering figure, ignoring or turning away with no effort to maintain contact if picked up, and treats a stranger similarly to the caregiver. The child feels that there is no attachment, therefore the child is rebellious and has a lower self-image and self-esteem. And I'm talking more about avoidant insecurity. And the caregiver offers little or no response to a distressed child. I believe Anita also showed a tiny clip of that. And the caregiver discourages crying and encourages independence. Now we're talking about a baby to a toddler. In ambivalent bonding, the child is unable to use the caretaker as a secure base. Now, I know I said we all or whatever, but I think it's you know, there's a continuum. So you can just put yourself in. The child's unable to use the caretaker as a secure base, seeking proximity before separation occurs. Distressed on separation with ambivalence, anger, and reluctance to warm to the caregiver and return to play on return. In other words, they have to kind of keep checking in on the caregiver, the mother, and they can't relax and play. Preoccupied with caregiver's availability, seeking contact, but then resisting angrily when it's achieved. So the child is really ambivalent about this primary connection. In this relationship, the child always feels anxious because the caregiver's availability is never consistent. Now, for the mother or the caregiver's part, there's an inconsistency between appropriate and neglectful responses. Generally, will only respond after increased attachment behavior from the infant. So the baby has to keep finding ways to connect, but at the same time is angry, but because they're not really being met, their needs aren't being met. And the last one, the disorganized, disoriented attachment pattern. In the child, there's stereotypic behavior such as freezing and rocking. There's a lack of coherent attachment strategy shown by contradictory, disoriented behaviors such as approaching but backing into the person. And in the caregiver, she is frightened or frightening. She's intrusive, but withdrawn. She's negative. There's role confusion. Is this a child? Is this a friend? Is this a lover? Whatever. There's affective, emotional communication errors and maltreatment, very often associated with many forms of abuse toward the child. So we're all on that continuum, and nobody gets the perfect whatever. But what I really want to say about attachment is that in order to transform the archetypal affects of the self, rage, fear, anger, grief, those are archetypal affects, and all babies have those. We all have those. In order to transform them from overwhelming experiences, the caretaker has to be there securely for the child, and she has to contain the child, and she soothes and she languages what's going on. So there's this very complicated experience going on while the child is in the various affective states, and slowly, 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 she helps the child learn how to contain themselves. Okay, the second picture, Kate. And this is an Ovid quote, "We two form a multitude." And I show you this because, I mean, it is really quite a beautiful, ideal picture of a very happy baby and mother, eye to eye. And we are all at the mercy of the caregiver, the mother, when we're an infant. This is total dependency. And if you have a good enough mother, you know, bless you. And if you have a terrible mother, you are totally at the mercy of that figure. And a lot of unresolved early dependency issues are going to come up when we're sick, when we're aged, and when we're dying. So anything you don't get to work on, you'll have plenty of opportunity. So. Okay, now I'm going to go back to antiquity for just a second. Go forward. Yeah, these are eye idols. They're alabaster, and they're from the Temple of Ishtar in Syria, Israel. And see the open eyes, the all-seeing. And then back to now. And this is one of my heroes. That's right. That's Mr. Rogers. And I put this picture in because we're talking about very abusive men, but there are also, on the other end of the spectrum, these men such as Mr. Rogers who, and so far I haven't heard anything bad about his boys. I do love him. But this is adoration. Is that a beautiful picture? And I remind you, after parents teachers are the ones, and nuns and priests and whatnot, but the teacher in the classroom is the next person that you work on your attachment relationships with. And that is just so beautiful. But even more, this is a handicap classroom or challenge. And see the two children watching? And they are in a state of wonder and joy as well. And that's the thing about children, is that they experience vicariously and energetically. So, I mean, they're getting it too. And some of the studies I've read on moral development, we used to think it was more like about 8, but now we're finding that by 2 years old, that a child can hear his fellow child cry or be upset and will go and reach out and comfort them. And that is compassion. That is an emotional, physiological connection, and obviously comes from a child who's been comforted, and they comfort the other children. And I just love this picture. So,
Andy, can I say something about
sure.
this? I was not a cannabis provider myself, but until I lived in Pittsburgh, I didn't really understand what he meant when he talked about the neighborhood, because that's where he was from. And when I lived there, I realized the neighborhood was really an extension of the family. And so when he talks about it's a great day in the neighborhood or whatever, you know, it was really like this kind of community space, larger than the family, larger than the household. People would sit on their porches and talk across the street to each other, and people knew, like, if you drove down the street in a neighborhood that wasn't yours, people would watch you because they knew you didn't belong there. You weren't part of mm-hmm. that group.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gave me a whole new perspective on kind of what he was presenting, mm-hmm. you know, when he presented mm-hmm. himself in mm-hmm. that way.
I think it's wonderful. He really was all about relationship, whether it was to yourself, you know, I love you just the way you are, you know what I mean? But his pacing, too, was far more in match to a child. I love Sesame Street and all that, but it was too overstimulating. And Mr. Rogers has that slow pace where you can take something in and you can reflect, but he was all about relationship and the neighborhood. And even though there's a Sesame Street neighborhood too, his was really, you know, the porch and the mailman. And, you know, anyway, thank you, Mr. Rogers. And I want to say that at the basis for love relationships, for intimate relationships, is in your early attachment experience, or the repair of it, but the basis for intimacies is in early attachment. So the basis, this is Shiva and Shakti gazing at one another. That's the connection of the mother and baby, the father and baby. And if we have not worked on our insecurities from our insecure attachments, then that's going to come out in our intimate relationship. So that primary relationship really informs so much. At the core, we are all deeply shaped by our attachment patterns, and the depth of our complexes are related to attachment patterns, and the repair of the self and ego integration require really working on those attachment patterns. I mean, if you are in therapy or can go to therapy or analysis, it says to me that you have enough courage to sit in a room with another human being. And that might seem so normal to so many, but for a lot of people who have very difficult attachment histories, that's not safe. And they're not going to have therapy. They're not, even if they could afford therapy. And the mental health centers are not available or too expensive. So they're not going to get that kind of treatment. And they might get it at school. And one thing I do want to really support and honor Obama for suggesting or pushing is early pre-kindergarten intervention. It is one of the most economically, I mean, the consequences of not having a good attachment come out in every realm of life, particularly economic. So it's a really good investment, and I've read several articles by business leaders who are understanding that there's an economic impact to all of this as well. So, okay. So I just wanted to say a little bit about psychological defenses, because we all have them. I think it's the next one. Yeah. Nope, it's not that. That's Shiva. We all have psychological defenses. We're all aware that there's an overwhelming anxiety for potential annihilation. And we start developing defenses from the earliest interactions. And hopefully these defenses mature over time and we work on them. In fact, a lot of what analysis is about is analysis of psychological defensiveness, one way or another. And we can get there through the complexes, in particular, sometimes through dreams. Some of the most basic defenses are projection and denial. Some of the immature defenses are acting out, somatization, regression. And I could say a lot more, but I'm not going to go into that. Neurotic defenses are controllingness, displacement, repression, externalization, inhibition, sexualization, isolation. And I noticed there's a little confusion about where dissociation fits, and I was thinking about it. It's often placed later, closer to 7 years old. And I was thinking, you know, when a child's abused very early, there's nowhere for them to go. They don't even exactly leave their body. There's a shattering of the organization within them. So it's not, it's a very unconscious defense, dissociation. And intellectualization as a defense can be seen at 4, and it can become highly sophisticated, as we all know. At the other end, mature defenses are altruism, expectation, asceticism, humor, sublimation, suppression, postponing. All of them seem to have to do with the capacity to hold tension. Also the capacity for irony and metaphor and the comprehension of interrelatedness among lives. It's quite a sophisticated understanding. And the repair of early wounding, the deeper the wounding, I would say the longer the repair. And I think it's organic. And I think there is no quick fix for deep wounding. Then there's the head of Shiva. We can go back to that. And I use Shiva because there's the set of human eyes, but there's also the third eye, which is the eye of wisdom. It's the integrated eye that sees it all, that sees the interrelatedness of everything, so which is different than the Cyclops. Okay. And I just want to say a little bit more about Sandusky and Penn State and the Catholic Church, because of the profound wounding and the deep level of shame and violation of trust that's gone on in pedophilia. Many children are placed in foster care and programs such as Sandusky's Second Mile because they need help from more functional adults in the community. They've come from homes, often with disorganized mothers or single parents or special needs, including poverty. These children are especially vulnerable and dependent upon and at the mercy of the adults caring for them. their internal psychological vulnerability and physically a lack, there's physically a lack of protection and internally a lack of protection. These children are particularly vulnerable to predatory human behavior, such as the pathological narcissism of a Jerry Sandusky. And basically the effects last at least three generations to really heal the damage. And, well, the costs are enormous to the individual and to the society. So I very much support early intervention and far more training of early childhood educators. So I think what I'd like to do is... I'd like to also say that it wasn't lost on me that the Violence Against Women Act was passed by Congress last week, and yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that as I was finishing up my notes, that it was signed by Obama. Kate, I think there's a slide. Yeah, there it is. And part of what he talked about was how many people were involved in making this happen. And what was remarkable is it started in the 90s with Joe Biden, and it's expanded each time it comes up. And now Native American women are protected from rape on the reservation and abuse by white men. And GLBT people, women, are protected, and immigrants are protected, and victims of human sex trafficking are protected. There are a number of things I could have talked about today, but what I realized is that it's hard enough to even look at one of these things. And, you know, I've gone through periods where I study this stuff and I start dreaming of wearing sunglasses. You know, it's so hard to keep looking. One of the things that happened last week, as I was driving in, I came off of 91 and I was coming onto King Street. And I had an experience and I wrote about it, but I realized how important it was. I was pulling by a woman, I think it was a woman, she was sort of parked in a snowbank and slumped over her wheel. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, my gut reaction was, this woman's having a heart attack and somebody should do something about it. And again, in this flash of a moment, I thought, well, maybe somebody else has already called. Maybe I can just go by. And what happened was I realized I couldn't. So I took my iPhone out, and for the first time in my life, I dialed 911. And I'm looking in my rearview mirror because there's all kinds of traffic and no one's stopping and it's moving, and I see the woman sit up and get out of the car. So I push end immediately. And within 3 seconds, I got a phone call. A local phone call, and it was the 911 operator saying, "Ma'am, someone called from that number. Is there something I can help you with?" And I said, "Actually, it's okay. You know, things are all right, but thank you." She was incredibly nice. And I drove on, and I think it was life-changing in some way because it was such a moment of not turning a blind eye. And part of that is because in that moment I thought she was having a heart attack. I said to myself, that could be me. And what I'm talking about is the repair of kinship that is a lifelong process. I realized, you know, whether or not it was me, this is a woman who could be having a heart attack. And I cared. So it's been a lifetime of hard work internally, and it will go on until I'm not here. So anyway, that's what I wanted to present, and I will show you the last thing in the jar or the box is hope. And early in my analysis, I did a lot of artwork, and I did this piece, and this to me was kind of an ode to the wonder of the child, to the creative child, full of imagination, full of symbols, full of possibility. And, I spent a lot of time reclaiming and healing early experiences, and it, if anything, it just continues to release creativity in all kinds of ways. So I say that because this is, to me, about wonder and creativity, and given my history and a number of the people I've worked with, I can tell you it has been a journey, and the other side of deep work is the exquisite depth and beauty that's then accessible. Thank you. So I don't know what time it is, but I'd like to... I think Dan's doing lights. Okay, good. So we have a little time for questions. And does anybody want to share anything or any thoughts?
Well, I've just gone through a very painful separation, and I'm about to divorce, and I have to say it just really brought up a lot of thoughts about abandonment and the loss of abandonment.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you have someone to work with. Good, good. And, you know, it may be a very, very productive period in your life, and it also is very painful, but it brings up all of the basic stuff. You know, every loss pulls up all the losses, all of them. It's so, thank you.
I work with some families who I already see the attachment not going well. And it's happening right there. It's so hard. Because I think all the time, and like you said with education, like I wish I was even trained better to be able to deal with these. Because I think, how can I break through to these parents without making them feel bad, and how can I connect with them to show them ways that they could be doing different things with their children? They seem completely ignorant of.
Well, it's wonderful that you're allowed in the home, and whether or not you ever talk about what you're doing, you're modeling, you know, reaching out and bringing yourself into their atmosphere. It's very brave work, and I'm really glad you're doing it. Yeah, there's just so, you know, there's a lot of resilience in most children, you know. I mean, they can live on crumbs. I mean, I can't speak about the parents and whatnot, but children, it's amazing how much they can get from just the simplest kindness, and they carry it within them. And if it's reinforced when they get to school, that will strengthen it. So, are you with a certain program?
Well, I work for
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, it's early intervention. Sometimes, I mean, I work with the toddlers, but sometimes with babies there too, that I see.
Yeah. Wonderful. Lucky kids.
when you talked about the two anxiety and ambivalence as the attributed to the insecure relationship or mm-hmm. that affect. Mm-hmm. How do Jungians work with that?
Well,
I understand, you know, that's probably a whole lecture or a year or 5 years topic.
Well, one thing I'm thinking is some people have a very hard time really coming and staying in treatment. You know, they might come 4 sessions and then they got to go on vacation and then it's hard to get them back in. I mean, that's acting out the ambivalence for sure. And sometimes people do things instead of talk about them, such as they don't come in, and then my job is to feel my feelings and realize how much of that's me and how much is that person trying to tell me something. They might not even know it. But my job is to work with the transference and the counter-transference issues so that when they do come in, you know, I can understand better how difficult it is to sit in the room. And then there are people who are in the room, but they can't drop down. You know, it's very difficult to be in their feelings. And the dreams can sometimes really be very helpful in telling the story of what's going on. But, you know, trust versus mistrust is so basic, and it just sounds so simple, but it is a lifetime of really circling that.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by the powerlessness with an infant or a toddler, just to the parent behavior, just how they have to adapt to exactly what the parents are doing or how they attach is all dependent on the parents and if they respond by playing at their walls or mm-hmm. running away or being secure or insecure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I first had my first of 2 sons, I remember I was so exhausted that the baby was napping, Jesse. And I was laying on my bed, resting. He never slept more than 20 minutes. And I realized that this child is totally at my mercy. And that's an awesome thing to realize. That's a lot of responsibility. And that I realized, you know, what an incredible opportunity to support a human being or to destroy a human being. And I'm sure a lot of people who don't even ever think about that, but yeah.
And just the notion of letting a baby cry and spoil the baby, and just letting a baby cry and cry. Because I'm just thinking about my infancy. Did my mother do that?
We have learned a few things. But part of the crying is the affect is dysregulated. And, you know, there's a point at which the child cannot regulate itself. It's just lost inside that rage and fear. And,
I've actually thought a lot about that. Mm-hmm. A lot of my children, unfortunately, are reinforced too much for crying, so they don't learn how to communicate in another way.
Mm.
So we try to teach the parents when not to respond to their kid, because the kid just cries for everything they want.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trained to think, to actually, and I think because of the way I was raised, I sometimes can get really hard. And like, when a child is crying, I'm like, well, I'm just going to wait for them to get over it, and then I'll give them attention when they're doing things I want them to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I'm starting to look at this and wonder about it and notice the hardness in myself.
Mm-hmm.
When that line is, when do you go to the child when they're crying, or when, like, this child's crying for everything. They need to learn how to just pacify themselves.
That's right.
Instead of always being pacified by the parents.
Also, in a pretty secure attachment, there's an attunement. And, you know, babies have all kinds of different kinds of crying, or a child. And, you know, you have a sense of that. You know, you have a relationship, and you kind of know when somebody's really, you know, really grumbling or really scared or, you know. So, but when it's someone else's child, it's a little harder. And I think a lot of times, a lot of people think Jungian analysis stays in an intellectual place. And in fact, that's only a part of it. It's a lovely part to bring, you know, to talk about symbols and all that stuff. And I love that. But there's so much underneath of that that is in the affective realm that we, you know, I think we're learning so much more about. You know, the trauma studies really didn't emerge until after the Vietnam War, when there was an epidemic of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so all this money went into research, and then they began to apply it to domestic violence and rape. And, you know, so there was this explosion of learning about PTSD. I think that's part of what's going to come out of the Iraq War is the brain injury work, and a lot more around cognition and neuropsychology, because there's a lot of money in the research. So, but I think if you're really skillful when you work with dreams, you know, there's just so much you can read in it beside the intellectual part. Although that can be, you know, that can be thrilling and interesting to talk about culture and whatnot. But there's so much more than that. So, Kel.
The phrase for me, you know, that you said, right hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
I always get in trouble. I was raised a little young in an Italian family, and there was so much affective connection. I just think about it, the touch. Man, I'm always answering it, but my training 100 years ago, in the analytic community in Manhattan, I got criticized for touching.
Oh my goodness, yes.
No, really. I
believe you.
Thrown out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I actually hugged a patient in a moment of joy. You know, I was always breaking the room.
Good.
You know, so I was getting in trouble. It was tiresome. But anyway, you know, those were just a few words. But even in the present, I remember when the I remember when the EMDR was coming out. And I find that so useful. So in certain situations, and I honor it, not in any way. Mm-hmm. But my response was to George Abbott, he was head of the clinical program at Holyoke Hospital at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He said, George, you've done it again. You've got a technique where two people sit in a room without moving, and all you do is move their fingers, and it's time efficient. You know, there've got to be other modes of treatment, and I'm serious about that. You're talking about, you're using these words. Right brain to right brain. I mean, I think that there's a potential with the Jungians, and I'm not a Jungian. I'm only impressed with some of the people who are Jungians. But to me, why I'm impressed is that I feel the Jungians keep talking about more.
Mm-hmm.
Keep talking about something, even in contemporary times, with all the wonderful research that's happening. The brain, there's more. Mm-hmm. And isn't it empathy and body to body? Mm-hmm. And all that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that, you know, you even, you don't, you talk, the Jungians talk, include the word gut. My gut tells me one thing, and yet I resist what my gut tells me.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, in listening to you again, I actually am of the opinion that at this point in history, the unions might actually carry a piece that isn't strong enough in the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, relational work is the only thing that reaches the early attachment issues that we're struggling with. It has to be relational, you know. That's not enough, you know, because that's where all the mess comes out, is the relational stuff. So, yeah. Michael?
Well, I was thinking right brain to right brain. I met a guy's native and ended up doing a lot of combat stuff during South America and then treated his own PTSD for 20 years with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the elders asked him to step up and take part in a lot of ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And PTSD stuff went away.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a lot of stuff with veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Ceremony, mm-hmm. ritual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is very,
you know, if you have a relatively secure base, or at least you're sort of moderately insecure, and you go off to war and you experience all that, you might have trauma, but you don't have the degree of destruction because there is this secure place deep inside you. But a lot of people go off to war, they're poor, they're disorganized, they're already not well put together, and then you put them in the most stressful situation of all, and they're going to fall apart. They're going to really have a hard time. Yeah, the suicide. I didn't even get into the military rapes and the suicides and all that, but and I think people, were very people are always unprepared to go to war. You know, it's. I always wondered, or I've been wondering, what impact being in a neutral country might have had on Jung, for instance. I just never really thought about that deeply, but it's like, what is that like when your society has made that decision?
I kind of thought that the title of tonight's talk would speak more to neutrality, meaning I'm not in the human services profession,
mm-hmm.
so I don't feel like I'm the perpetrator or the afflicted. I'm sort of the impassive middle audience.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of hoping you might draw out, and you sort of did with that 911 call, when is the appropriate time to intervene as a sort of a lay intervener?
Mm-hmm.
Because turning a blind eye is inherently a conundrum, right? I mean, you're actually triggering an action. You're turning into a decision into an action, and you're turning out into complete passivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of an affliction, that's sort of a guilt that I know I carry,
mm-hmm.
As a non-participant.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
maybe if you could address that.
Well, I do know that we're limited in how much we can attend to, and there's so many needs in all kinds of spheres. So part of it is you have to be realistic with yourself, what you can do, what you can respond to. I think back when I was much younger, we weren't really taught, you know, what you do if you're going to intervene. You know, do you call social services? What do you do? So I think... give me an example.
Two people are shouting at each other in a subway station. My instinct is to go as far to the end of that platform as possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, that may be your gut instinct, which is to take care of yourself, because that may be the best thing to do, because they may be two really irrational people who are caught in this rage place, and it's actually wise for you to step out of it if there's some sort of extra... I also feel like law and law enforcement people and all that, it's external. It's external structure and protection. And I think when people are dysregulated, they need more of that external management. So I just want to say maybe your gut is saying, you know, keep you safe because you know that's more than you can handle. And if there's external help around,
Mm-hmm. And it's cultural. Just to
waiting for the to go to the next place, but it wasn't quite dark yet, and two men were arguing, and they got into a really heated, loud fight. And the norm in that culture is to surround them. So there was a crowd, and I was standing up where I could see things, and someone came up to the two men that were just raging at each other and actually calmed them down. And the two men started to cry and hug each other. But I noticed a lot of this thing where the crowds would come around.
So going back to your point, I don't think we're taught to surround. I think our culture is disengaged. You know, that's what we're taught. And I think it would take a lot of change for us to... I mean, if you looked at the Vatican and the Penn State, there was this way they surround their own, but unfortunately it's not to help a conflict, but to hide a problem. So I think we need a lot more education in kinship and community and neighborhood. Yeah.
You know, one thing about living in Switzerland, which I did for a while during my union training, is, and I don't know if this has to do with neutrality or not, but people take individual responsibility for social stuff. So if you inadvertently drop a Kleenex on the ground, someone will, you know, tap you on the shoulder and say, "You dropped that, pick it up." Or there's a rule that you, if you're stopped at a traffic light or just stopped, if you're going to be idling for more than 60 seconds, you must turn off your car. And, you know, these Swiss businessmen in these fancy suits will knock on the window and say, you know, turn off your car. So people take individual responsibility.
Interesting.
You know, even though they're not going to war or something. And I found it delightful to live in a culture where people took that responsibility. I mean, in my culture, I feel like if I said pick up that thing, I might get shot. You know, who knows what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
That just reminds me of I was in the grocery store once, and a baby was crying in the checkout. And this woman, another woman, not the mother, she just couldn't believe that the mother was crying. And she just had this attitude of almost like a rage, like, "Oh, like, why didn't she do something about it?" And I said, "You've never heard a baby cry?" And I just had this like, gut reaction that I just needed to like put her in her place. And I couldn't believe that I said that. And then she was like, "Oh, how could you say that to me?" Get over it, you know? And usually I wouldn't do that, but I was like, "Please, you know, like, so what?"
Oh, good. See, you could have gone away, but something in you said, "Lady."
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And she was probably projecting her own internal discomfort that she hasn't attended to.
Yeah.
You know.
And then whatever got triggered in me. And
there you go. There you go.
Down a pepper.
Right. Oh. Well, for instance, I'll just give a little bit of an example. Matt Sandusky was with Second Mile as an 8-year-old. And then he was adopted. And he was the one who came out at the end of the trial and said, "My father abused me." But because they couldn't prove rape, and the statute of limitations had passed, his testimony and whatnot wasn't used other than to get the truth out there. So, anyway, when he was at the Sandusky household, he attempted suicide with an overdose. He dreaded Sandusky's approaches, etc. When he was treated for the overdose, he said, I guess I want to go back there because they're so good to me. And so think of how mixed up things were, but then he got married And he took his children over to his father's house, and his wife insisted on a restraining order. I mean, this was before all this, but so here's this kid. He's a mess, and he needs the connection, but at what cost? And then his kids would be, that's just talking about how complicated things get. So. Richard, did I touch some of the stuff you've been thinking about?
Oh, yes. I'm thinking, Sandusky and the papacy are the such dark, masculine elements in when the mess gets total messy. And I'm guessing also with respect to this attachment, generally, as a caregiver, most of them, always the mother. Mm-hmm. I know a number of young fathers, including some of my own sons, who mm-hmm. are in that role. Mm-hmm. But without the proper good enough relationship between the caregiver and the caregiver's spouse or partner, mm-hmm. the opportunity for a good enough attachment mm-hmm. Is diminished the opportunity for more likely insecure or mm-hmm. disorganized or disoriented mm-hmm. attachment is there. So I'm just thinking of the absent father or the not good enough father, the distracted father or whatever, mm-hmm. who's part of whatever attachment mm-hmm. results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I also felt with the Sandusky case that I couldn't look away, and last year I was working on a research project at UMass that involved citation counts for faculty productivity at UMass and a number of other departments, and I ended up looking at research done by the sociology department at Penn State because I was looking at how much those folks had published in comparison to other departments, and mm-hmm. so I was often looking at the titles of the papers that people had mm-hmm. published. Senior male faculty who had done a lot of research on testosterone, which I did not encounter in any of the other departments that I looked at. I looked at about 12 or 13 different departments, which were the ones chosen as sort of the peer departments to the UMass program. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that they weren't doing research on testosterone in the 70s and 80s in other sociology departments. Probably some places they were, but I just thought at the time that this was all coming out, it sort of made me wonder about, not just what was going on in athletics at Penn State, on that side of mm-hmm. the institution, but, there seemed to be this sort of focus on, kind of masculinity and sexuality at the mm-hmm. level of the hormones, and that was what people in academia, were doing as well. So just kind of interesting mm-hmm. in the context of, what we're looking at here that it was pervasive. The other people that I can't stop watching are like the Lance Armstrongs.
Oh, I wanted to say one comment. Buzz Bissinger, who identified this whole thing as evil, he idolized Lance Armstrong. He, in fact, did not believe it could be possible. And at least he had the good sense to write something and say, I can't believe that I didn't see it. And I think people want heroes. They want superhuman heroes, and it is very painful. So I give him credit for coming back and saying, wow, I couldn't see it. So,
but I think it speaks to how pervasive.
It is really pervasive. And all the football head injuries that's starting to come out. So, yeah. Well, thank you very much.